Pico Iyer has been celebrated as one of the most soulful and perceptive writers of our time, with books translated into 23 languages, TED Talks enjoying more than 11 million views, and a storied career as a longtime essayist for Time Magazine, The New York Times, and many other outlets. He may be the greatest cross-cultural observer of our modern age. For half a century now, he has traveled the globe and observed people grappling with the most foundational questions of existence. How to find happiness? How to connect with something true? What constitutes a meaningful or useful life? Out of this journey comes his brand new book, The Half-Known Life, In Search of Paradise. It is published by Riverhead, and it is a great honor to welcome Pico Iyer to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. It's a great privilege and delight for me to be talking to you.
Very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to this search, really, a search for paradise?
I think two things. First, the pandemic. Literally 20 hours after lockdown was announced here in California, my poor mother, who was 88, was raced into hospital in an ambulance. She was losing blood very quickly. And so I soon flew over from my little apartment in Japan to be with her. And for the next 6.5 months, I was with my mother as she was wavering between life and death and sharing the anxiety that everybody knew at that time. And so I was thinking, given we're all living in a time of uncertainty, how can I make this uncertainty as rich and warm and comfortable as possible and maybe find some degree of calm and contentment, even in the midst of difficulty and loss? The other great thing was, since I was spending 6.5 months with my mother not traveling, it gave me a good chance to think back on my 48 years of constant travel that you just mentioned and try to see what it had all added up to.
Given that it is the title of the book, how do you mean and how do you define the half-known life?
Again, maybe two ways. I think the surface way is I really feel that we're living in this age of information, but we know less about the rest of the world than ever before. And actually, we know least of all about the countries we hear most about, such as Iran and North Korea, my first two destinations in this book, or Cuba or Yemen. We may know a little bit about their leaders or their economy or their nuclear policy, but we know very, very little about daily life and regular folks. The deeper meaning, I think, for that half-known life is I really feel all our lives are determined by things we can't explain. We fall in love. A virus suddenly arrives and locks down the whole world. A forest fire comes and burns down our house, as happened to me once. We suddenly are moved to tears by some beautiful sight in Tibet. We can't begin to explain what's going on in those moments, or to control them, or to anticipate them. But I do think our life is almost shaped by what we do with what we can't explain. And the pandemic, of course, was a perfect example of that.
You say the book is really less about searching for paradise than about investigating our ideas of it, and understanding that it can't be found anywhere but right here, right now, wherever that may be.
Perfect. Exactly. You summarized the book in one sentence better than I could in my 200 pages. But just so. I mean, I think, as I say, you know, there I was stuck with a mother in the last months of her life, but there was still beauty around me. There were still wonderful surprises. There was still joy that we exchanged. And I suppose I only trust a paradise that can be found in the middle of real life and in the face of death and impermanence.
When you started to look at the book and you look at the travels, you look at the people, you look at what you were mentioning, North Korea a moment ago, and you the book begins in Iran, I believe. And what brought you to those places as you were writing to really be the kickoff to bring you to the message that you wanted to convey?
Yeah, because you're right that Iran and North Korea aren't the first places people think of when they're talking about paradise. Because I've been lucky to travel a lot, I've been to Bali and Tahiti and the Seychelles and Antarctica and a lot of the places that the travel agents' posters present as paradise. And I often think, well, they're paradise for me as a visitor for 2 weeks, but probably not for the local, for whom it's real life. And if I really did find some paradise, what could I have to offer to it? I would only be offering corruption. I'd be the serpent in the garden, bringing it down to earth. So I've never been interested in the most obvious cases of paradise. I started with Iran and North Korea because they're both kind of utopian visions. Iran is the biggest or most prominent theocracy in the world, and North Korea is a kind of secular theocracy. They both, their leaders hold that they're creating a paradise on earth, and Iran is actually the place that gave us the word paradiser. And one of the surprises of being in Iran is that you will step out into a garden in after nightfall, and there's a sound of running water, and there are fragrant flowers all around, and colorful lights, and you're led to a divan and invited to stretch out and sip tea and eat sweet slices of watermelon. It really does feel more like an earthly paradise than anywhere I've ever been. But of course, the ruling clerics say paradise belongs only in the afterlife, mostly to martyrs. The place in Iran called Zahra's Paradise is one of the biggest cemeteries in the world, with 1.5 million people there. And so Iran seemed like a good way for seeing all these conflicting visions of paradise, because, of course, one of the problems with paradise is your vision of paradise probably isn't mine, so it's hard to make a collective paradise.
In Iran, you are talking to dissidents. You write in the book that you were there for a very long time early in your career. You wrote 20 years earlier, you had written a 20-page article for Smithsonian Magazine. You returned later. And you say, now, however, within 20 hours, I was finding myself in the middle of something far richer than any of my ideas, a dissident risking his being to steal back into a land he'd risked his being to escape, and a deeply devoted Islamic soul I'd witnessed with my own eyes who did not wish to live in an Islamic republic. How did that change your view, that seeing that change your view of Iran?
Well, to be honest, I had written that long piece on Iranian history before I ever went there. And I'd once spent 4 years reading up and researching Iran, and I published a 350-page novel partly set there, but I'd never been. So, in fact, I've only been to Iran once, but I had been studying it for 30 years, and I thought I was pretty well prepared. But just as you said, within 4 hours of arriving, after 30 years of preparation, I saw I didn't know a thing. And that wonderful incident you're referring to, my very first night, I slipped away from my official guide. I went to the largest mosque on the planet with a young driver. And this young driver was just a picture of Islamic piety. Tears were welling in his ears as he looked at the shrine of a saint who had been dead for 1,200 years. And then when we walked back to his car, he told me how his wife was a blonde Yorkshire woman waiting for him in England. He'd paid a human trafficker $2,500 to smuggle him into England in the back of a truck. And he now had won amnesty status so that he could live in England. And yet he was stealing back into the country he'd risked his life to escape because he missed his mother in his hometown and the mosque so much. And so it just reminded me how complicated things are, which we don't always get in our headlines. Here was a sort of official dissident who was coming back into that country. And you can't make simple distinctions about who believes in the revolution or who doesn't, because he believed and didn't believe at the same time. So my first night in Iran, I realized my ideas about it were much too simple.
Pico Iyer is our guest. The new book is The Half-Known Life in Search of Paradise. You've talked about writing books about the outer world and then being determined to write about exploring the inner. And so bring us to where those two meet, of the journey is where they meet.
That's a wonderful question. And I think all of us know that paradise only lives inside us. It's got to do with a way of seeing and a way of being. And so maybe that's one reason at the middle of this book I have a lot of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, because I've known him for 48 years. He's a great traveler. He's constantly crisscrossing the globe, the first Dalai Lama in history to leave Asia and come everywhere from New York City to Belfast and Jerusalem. And yet what he's speaking for, of course, is the notion that we shouldn't be thinking about paradise. We should be doing what we can to make it real with our friends and neighbors right now. So he's one of the most visible people in the outer world, but he's speaking of the inner world. And for me, the inner world is much more important, because when I flew back across the Pacific Ocean to be with my mother, as she'd come out of the hospital and I didn't know how long she would survive, material things weren't really going to help me. All the money I had in the bank wasn't going to help her as she was struggling to breathe. Medicine would, of course, and a good doctor, but the books I'd read, the books I'd written, none of that was of much use to her or to me. And I felt the only thing that I could bring to that situation, which is a situation every human being faces in different ways, was my inner savings account, as it were. You know, whatever resources I'd gained from sitting still, from reflection, from understanding experience, that the outer world is only as rich as the inner world beneath it. I remember many, many years ago, the great German mystic Meister Eckhart said, as long as the inner life is strong, the outer life will never be puny. In other words, if you've got a solid foundation inside, then your relationships, your career, your finances, everything can take care of itself. But if you don't have that foundation inside yourself, we all know all the money in the world and all the power is not going to help you.
One of the things you say about the lockdown is it allowed you to, quote, sift the essential from the fleeting. It's a beautiful line.
Thank you. And, you know, I think I'm speaking for pretty much everyone on the planet at that time. You know, so one of the things the lockdown gave us was a sharpened sense of priorities. What do we really care about and how do we stay close to it? And I've been very moved at how so many of the people I know are living very differently after the lockdown. They've decided this is what I really care about and I'm going to remake my life in the light of that. And a part of me feels that so many of us, I speak for myself, we're kind of joyriding in a Porsche around blind curves in 2019. We're living very, very quickly without really the chance to think about whether we were going in the right direction. And suddenly the pandemic brought this roadblock. And some of us were jolted awake and thinking, actually, why are we doing that when really what our heart and soul calls for is something different? And I bet most of the people listening to this conversation are in some ways leading better lives or lives closer to the way they wanted than they were 4 years ago, even though we're all sort of economically in ruin and so much has been devastated during the pandemic.
And there still seems to be division. There seems to be anger, but we always have that common experience, correct?
Exactly. And you know, that's what I've really learned as a traveler. When I sit here in California and I think about Syria or Cuba or Iran, I really think about everything that's different in those countries from the way things are here. And as soon as I get off the plane in Damascus or Havana or Tehran and I start talking to people, I'm reminded just of that human commonality you just mentioned. You know, most of them, they're complaining about their government, they're worried about the economy, they're anxious about their kids. They sound just like people in the United States. And as you say, we're living in a world that's ever more connected, but more divided. And I think part of the division is our sense of, well, our abstractions, our theories, our ideologies, my belief, I know better than you, or I know more than you. And I think if you're convinced that you have more to learn than to teach and that you don't know so much, that instantly is going to bring you closer to most of our global neighbors.
And what you just said, which you bring out beautifully in the book, is that there is a beyond the answers that we think we know. The answers that perhaps separate us as well.
I wonder, exactly. Yes, precisely. You know, I heard after I completed the book that Pope Francis is, I think, another global hero. When he prays, doesn't pray for an answer to his problems. He only prays for the strength and clarity to live in the absence of answers. He knows that there's no answer to real life. We're all going to lose our loved ones. We're all every now and then going to fall sick or face a pandemic. And there's not so much we can do about it. The only thing that's going to make a difference is if we can find the strength to endure in the midst of those many answerless surprises. So yes, the world beyond answers and the world beyond explanations is just what's going on here. And as you know, at the center of this book, I have Jerusalem, which is the center of three great monotheisms. And I'm not a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew. But when I'm walking around the streets of Old Jerusalem, there are things that move me almost to tears. There's definitely some power there. But on our doctrines and divisions and say this is the only way, somehow we're in the midst of something man-made rather than heaven-made. So Jerusalem, to me, is a perfect example of where so many different groups are at odds, and even Sunni Muslims are at odds with Shia Muslim, ultra-Orthodox Jew is at odds with his secular cousin. Six Christian orders share the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, but are often fighting one another with brooms. So we're all kind of in these systems or beliefs that divide us, and yet there's something beyond all that, just as you said, and beyond answers, that really would stir everybody, even somebody like me who doesn't belong to those religions. And there's my favorite moment in Jerusalem is that there's a sign outside the Basilica of the Agony saying, please, no explanations inside the church. It's aimed at tour guides who want to talk too much, but I think it's a wonderful phrase because a church has real power. The explanations maybe don't.
You use the phrase the big open spaces in the book that may ultimately bring us together. Do we have to find those big open spaces, or are they there readily?
I think they're readily all around us. Thank you for reading the book so carefully and inspiringly.
Great honor.
I think of my life as like a little tent up in the Himalayas at night. And so maybe I've got some lanterns there and a flashlight, but it's just this little piece of light surrounded by a very big darkness of the heavens, pockmarked by stars and the outline of the silver mountains. And it's as if what I know is so small and what I don't know and can't explain is so big. And I think the more we root ourselves in what we don't explain, whether it's love or faith or wonder, whatever it might be, the more we're brought together. And the more we hold on to the tiny things we know, the more we're separate. And it's, as you know, it's not difficult to find those things. It's just a matter of being open to them and remembering right now outside your window, there's something that could leave you speechless and is probably more interesting than your ideas about it.
There is such wisdom and hope in this book. It is absolutely beautiful. It is The Half-Known Life in Search of Paradise. It is published by Riverhead Books. Pico Iyer, a great honor to have you on the program. I thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for inviting me, Joe, and thank you for highlighting the hope, because that's what I most want to pass on in sometimes difficult times.
Absolutely. Pico, thank you very much. Great pleasure.
Thank you, Joe. I'm really glad we could make contact.
Again, Pico Iyer's new book is The Half-Known Life in Search of Paradise. The book is published by Riverhead. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.